figure it out.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Sanak Audio, host, and guess what? It's Tuesday night. That means it's Indigenous Caribbean Study Hour, and you know what that means, right? Natalie, humor.
Yeah.
My Jesus.
Sorry, no, I'm doing a little early. I was trying to spare you the agony of trying to say my last name.
No, it's the Huber, right? Huber. I wouldn't say Uber, but
Huber. I know you always. It sounds like Uber, but it's an H, so it's Huber.
See, the H, normally the H is silent, but you know what? Every week.
I mean. Yeah, it could be. Maybe that's how the Germans say it. We've always said Huber. I answer to both because I'm used to being called both. So.
Oh, that's so cool,
yeah.
Man. But you know what?
Yeah, I'll
the
have
bottom
to ask,
line is, what's that?
We're here.
The bottom line is from all the way from the mountains of Cubao and
that's right.
The city of brotherly and sisterly love, Philadelphia, via New Jersey, Lenny Lalapi territory. We got this, man. Natalie Sanagori all the way, right? How's it going? How you feeling,
yeah.
Man? How you feeling?
I'm good, man. I just got back from the Rotowana's powwow this weekend. It was a great time. The weather was definitely messing with us, though. Like Saturday, first day, right? It says it's going to rain, but the whole day it's super, super hot. And, like, I'm talking, like, 90s. And this is up in the mountains, right, like Pocono Mountains. So you're thinking should be a little cooler. It wasn't. It was so hot. It was, after the grand entry alone, I was sweating my ass off. And just, like, I kept dripping down more and more of my regalia. And we were all just getting so hot. And then it kept saying, y'all, it's going to rain. Never rained. Then on Sunday, it was supposed to be nice. And guess what happens on Sunday? Temperature drops down to like 70 degrees and it's raining all day. But we still danced, of course, because, you know, that's how we roll. So we was all dancing in the rain and just, you know, rolling with it like we do, powwow style. Got a little muddy, a little wet, of course. You got to be careful with those feathers and everything when you're doing that. But we kept going. Yeah, we kept going. So it was just, you know, it was just, I think, a really nice testament. It's like no matter what the weather throws at us, we're always ready to dance, right? We're always ready to powwow. We're always ready to praise the ancestors and the spirits through dance and song. Because people were asking me, they were like, oh, well, is this still going to happen in the rain? I was like, hell yeah, it's still going to happen. we don't care. We've handled worse. So it was a great time, you know. So got to see some fellow Taino people there. Got to saw some friends from before, from the Pottstown powwow. Had some good food, some good fry bread. Of course, you always got to have the fry bread. And it was a really beautiful area too. Like, you know, weather aside, that mountain range is just gorgeous. And you get to really see, like, it's just when you're driving through there, it's beautiful scenery. So it's exhausting whenever you come back from a powwow weekend, but it's always a good time. It's always fun. You always feel like you're among family when you're there. And and that's why I'm looking forward to the one coming up this weekend in Queens too, that I'll see you at, right?
Yeah, let me tell you, I'll be there. Yep, definitely. I'm gonna hike out there and gonna go my little some of the books I'm bringing out, Digis Mobile Library. See what
we
can do.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, you know, little by little, we're getting back to the norm, right? With little precautions there, of course. But that's
right,
awesome. I mean, we get to dance again. Once again, we'll get to dance the Indigenous Caribbean study hour. We'll be dancing.
And that'll be great to have our own live study hour there.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm surprised you said that they were still dancing, because a lot of powwows they'll cancel the circle, the dance circle, because of the rain messes up feathers, you know.
Well, what happened was it started just after they put the flags up, and they were a little worried about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, they were saying, the MC was saying, everybody be careful with your feathers, and they took some breaks in between, because the rain wasn't constant. You know, it was sort of off and on. Like, it would start a little, then it would stop, it would start, it would stop. So
So
I'm grateful for that, because it meant we could still do it when there was a break in the rain. And thankfully it wasn't super heavy rain. It was kind of light. I felt good at first because of the heat from the day before, but then you always got to watch those feathers. And we had some jingle dress dancers, and they were trying not to get their bells rusty, you know. But we powered through. We had a good crowd, a good turnout despite the rain. That's the good thing, I guess, about the Queens one is that it'll be indoors, so we don't have to worry about that, right?
Oh, in Queens one? No, it's outdoors in Queens.
Oh, it's outdoors? I thought it was inside the museum.
Yeah, it's actually a farm. It's the oldest farm in Queens. And there's animals, there's wildlife there, actually. They have chickens.
Oh, sweet.
And...
Okay, well, never mind. hopefully we'll have
good outdoors.
Weather.
Yeah, definitely. I think they're going to follow some precautions again and social distancing, I think. You have to register online.
Oh, so, do you?
You know. Yeah, definitely. And there's also a Taino descent person, Marie Ponce. She's in charge of organizing the powwow. She's done a great job. You know, Marie Ponce, she's from the Bahamas.
That's right. I saw her
she's
name.
Indigenous from the Bahamas. The Luca.
She
calls herself Lucayo. She's Lucayo.
Lucay. Okay. So they're a related tribe, I believe, right?
Right. Exactly. And I'll introduce her, because guess what? In her family, they have a lot of the traditions. Traditions. There's a lot of cultural continuity when she was sharing a lot of stuff she knows. And I'm like, man, that sounds like indigenous cultural continuity to me. You know, so.
Yeah, I bet. People from the, you know, you meet a lot of Buriken Tainos, a lot of, Kiskeya and Cubao, but not as many from that area. So I'm always interested to, meet them and see what traditions they have, how alike and different they are to ours. It's always really cool.
Oh, definitely. It's going to be a fun time, I'll tell you. It's good. And there's a lot of people from the local area, the Matinacock people, the indigenous people of Queens. It's always good to see them. That's their land, you know. So
that's who it is? It's not Lenape. It's, what is it? Can you say it one more time for me?
Oh, yeah. Matinacock.
Matinacock
people. Yeah, I know ceremonial chief Reggie. He's a good friend of mine for many years. He's a medicine man. Yeah, I heard a lot of great. When hear a good story? I don't know if you know Queens that well. Yeah, but it's that whole area
Queens
where.
That well?
Yeah.
I mean, I lived in Manhattan, I've been to Queens, not to, I didn't know there was a farm there. I mean, I think of Queens, I think of like the city. I didn't know it. That's why when like you were talking about it, I was like, there's a farm in Queens? What?
But it's kind of cool because that whole area, Douglaston and LaGuardia Airport, College Point, that's all Tinnacock land. And what happened, I remember Chief Arciola was giving a lecture once, and he was saying that when the once America became America, and they showed up, they call them the surveyors, the land surveyors. These are the ones that are going to decide, you know, where the tribes are going to be forcefully moved.
Right, right.
So they went to the Tinnacock chiefs, and they were like, and the surveyor pointed, like, west. He says, oh, that's where you have to move your people. And then the Tinnacock chief was like, oh, over there? He's like, yeah. Oh, we can't go there. That's swamp land. We can't build our homes there. We can't grow our crops there. We don't go there.
And
then the surveyor pointed east. He says, hey, how about that way? Oh, no, that's where we bury our dead. We can't live there. No way. We honor our dead there. Then the surveyor started scratching his head. He says, all right. And he pointed north. How about that area? Oh, no. We definitely, the soil is too hard. You know, we can't dig. We can't farm. You know, no way. We can't go there. So then the survey looks at the chief and says, wait, hold on. You can't go there. Where are we going to put you? So the chief looks at the surveyor. He says, so the chief pointed to the ground they were standing. How about here?
And did it work?
How about here? No, that's a good question. Historically,
yeah.
they refused to move. And guess what? They're still under the U.S. law or U.S. history. It's the Tinnacock is still declaration of war. They're still at war with the United States because they never moved. They didn't want to move.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a famous shopping mall. Yeah, there's this famous shop. It's called Queens Mall. It's huge.
Okay.
And they put it right in the middle of a village, Tinnacock Village. And since they didn't want to move, they said, all right, we'll just build around here. And then what happened was there's a house there. And there's a cemetery in the middle of this Queens Mall. And in recent times, they petitioned the mayor to give them more room because if they need to call 911, an ambulance can't even fit through the road there to get to their house. And the cemetery is still there, the ancient cemetery that they built.
Wow.
Once the Americans took over. So that's right now, 2021. They're still under the Declaration of War. So they've never been federally recognized because of that. So they consider, what do you call that? Hostiles. Under the books.
It's so crazy because, you know, people don't, like, I mean, obviously this, all of the Americas were, you know, Indian land at one point. And it's like we forget, like, that what Manhattan now, and New York City, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country that's so urban was Indian land, and we forget like who was living there, and a lot of the names we get for certain places. And I think was it the Tinnacock that sold Manhattan for like out of some real crazy price to the colonists, like the equivalent of like $20 or something.
Well, that's the Dutch viewpoint, but it's a lie.
Dutch, okay.
Actually, Inwood Park has we call it Shiraka Park Rock. They still feed that lie, you know, about that it was.
Yeah, that's what's in the history books and everything. Or...
Right. So the real history is it was a matter of sharing. You know, the Lenape was like, yeah, sure, we'll share it. But they say, we're taking over. So they said it was because there was no concept of purchasing, selling.
Right,
traditional Lenape way. So
no concept of purchasing land in a lot of places.
Yeah. The thing that's cool about that history that's kind of sad as well, the last of the holdouts in Manhattan Island, right, were pushed out. Their Trail of Tears was from Manhattan Island. Just picture this already. From Manhattan Island in the winter, they were pushed to Oklahoma.
Yeah, like a lot of.
I believe Yep. Imagine that, Manhattan Island to Oklahoma. I was reading some books. It was like 80% died, right?
80%
died.
Yeah.
Those descendants, the survivors, are still in Oklahoma. Yep, they're still in Oklahoma.
Right.
And guess what? One of your fellow tribes member, Alexi Cruz of Higuayagua, he made a connection with some of the Lenape there many years ago. He made a connection. And they told him some oral tradition. They said it was the island indigenous that brought us tobacco for the Northeast. It's in their oral tradition. Yeah, yeah, man.
That's
so
awesome.
So they brought back, they gifted Alexi with some sage, Sundance sage, and they wanted to gift, you know, myself that do the ceremonies on the land there. So I got some sage, some Sundance sage from those Lenape. So you see, there's that connection.
That's awesome.
Our people, man.
Yeah,
our
absolutely.
People,
we're all over
thousands
the
of years. We're all over, man. We were here, man. We were Northeast.
Yeah,
we were
global.
We were chilling,
yeah,
man.
It's
we bought
crazy.
Tobacco with
Alexi's
us.
Alexi's funny, though. He posts some funny stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's cool, man.
Yeah, he always
little...
posts, like, these dad jokes.
Oh, man. I did a little workshop for him a couple of years ago. Talking about the Ustinoids, you know, the Ustinoids.
Yeah.
For the
beginning, yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's cool, man. So listen, today we're going to talk about symbols, right? Symbols, petroglyphs, the significance, right, of what is that? So go for it, man. If you
want
to share some of
let's do it.
Yeah, man.
This is something that what I love about symbolism, especially as like a, you know, an academic subject,
right.
is it's its own language, really, right? I mean, and there are some symbols that are kind of universal or at least spread across cultures. I mean, a lot of the time, some symbols mean one thing in one place or to one group of people and will mean something completely different to another, and we run into that a lot. But then there's some stuff that winds up becoming universal, right, and that a lot of people recognize, you know, especially when it comes to signage, when it comes to things that could be dangerous, when it comes to, you know, anything that, like, we use symbols all the time in our daily lives, right? We read symbols. They are like a universal language of their own. And one of the big things that they're great for is not only for kind of utility, like a lot of the times, like, symbols were used ceremonially for protection, for, you know, for fortune, fertility, all kinds of things, especially in indigenous cultures. But they're also great for our personal identification and everything, right? We see a symbol
right.
that we recognize being associated with something, and we immediately feel like a connection to that person if it's a symbol we associate ourselves with too. And I really noticed this at the powwow because, you know, with regalia, a lot of the time, especially us, like as Taino, like our traditional dress, we were basically naked, right? Or we didn't wear a whole lot of clothes. So we've had to, for powwow purposes, like a lot of other tribes, we've sort of kind of adapted and changed up, what our regalia would look like, where we incorporate some elements from other tribes, right? A lot of the more northern tribes, northeastern and eastern woodlands and plains have all been sort of incorporated into our regalia so that we're not, you know, as exposed as we once were. Same with we're not the only ones, of course, but that's sort of been the tradition of powwows in terms of the regalia we wear nowadays. It's not exactly what we would have dressed like back then necessarily, but it's more symbolic, right? Each color means something. Each, you know, each feather, each bead, each right down to individual paint that we wear, the colors we wear on our faces, the shells that we have hanging from our regalia. It all means something. It's all symbolic. And people recognize it, and what I noticed with the powwow this past weekend especially is even if you're, say, in regalia that's more kind of, I don't know, kind of standard, and someone may not be able to recognize, you know, what specific tribe you are or nation you are just based on your regalia, they'll see certain symbols that they'll recognize right away. Like, I had so many people come up to me when they saw the coqui on my earrings and immediately then recognized me as Taino. There was another guy who was Taino as well, but also Seminole, and he was dressed in, you know, Seminole-style regalia, like Eastern Woodland style. But he saw my, I had the son of Ayuya on my necklace, and he saw that. And then he showed me an armband that he had with the same symbol. So then we immediately recognized each other as Taino. And it was a really cool connection we were able to make just through seeing each other's symbols. And I incorporate a lot of that into my regalia. Obviously, I like to incorporate Taino symbols, the sun, the koki. I have my medicine pouch has a colibri, a hummingbird on it, because those were so sacred to us. So I really like including that. And it's always interesting just to see how people can recognize each other or some affiliation that people have through these very small symbols. You know, some of it is not very obvious, but if you know it, you know it, right? Like, we all, I think, recognize the coquín now. We all recognize the Hayuya sun, the atabe. A lot of symbols are just kind of standard in the world of the Taino community, right?
Yeah, that definitely. There's symbols pop out of the world. You know, especially the powwows, when you see the... Now, the big one I find that people really recognize is the atabe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also the yukahu, the three-pointer semi, that's a big...
Right.
That's a big one. So that's,
yeah, that one's becoming more and more recognized now, too.
Yeah, but definitely the coqui, I think, comes in first place, at least in Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah.
When you see the coqui.
Yeah. But now it's become, like, kind of universally Taino, right? Like, yeah, technically the coqui itself was only indigenous to Puerto Rico and is only found in Puerto Rico, but it's become like almost like a universal symbol of Taino. And when you see it and you see it drawn in that way specifically, you know it, right? You're like, oh, this person is either Boriken or Taino or both.
definitely. It's power, man. It's power. It's symbols. You should just, you know, and
yeah.
Thing about the coqui in Puerto Rico, it's, you hear them at night, they come out, millions of them.
Yeah, you hear them.
You know, it's, you know, not too long ago, I was talking to someone in Puerto Rico, and I guess it was around dusk time, and you can hear them in the background. I'm like, oh, my God.
It's crazy when they're, you know, they're so small, but they make such a big noise, you know. What I think is why our ancestors were so fascinated by them and believe them to be so powerful, because they were so small, but you know, one alone is loud, but then you get hundreds of them. And I know, because I've heard them, they'll keep you awake at night if they're all around you.
I mean,
and they're just all just singing loud, and it's just this tiny little thing, but the power they have to create this sound that's become so quintessentially associated with Gen and with our culture, right?
Let me tell you, true story, during COVID-19, when all this stuff was coming down, April, May, all these deaths, I had insomnia like most people with insomnia. They couldn't sleep well with anxiety.
Right.
I was out every night. I was playing on YouTube different soundtracks of coqui sounds, and that put me straight out. That put me to sleep.
Aww.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who are listening could probably relate to that. You know, you hear nature sounds.
Yeah.
Kind of relaxing.
Yeah.
But the coqui, that will knock you out if you ever experience coqui for a long period of time. You know, it's just comforting. Like, wow,
yeah,
I'm home, you know?
Is.
And I'm just
right.
Chilling.
It's like they're singing.
Exactly, they're singing. Yeah, they are, yep. It's their mating song.
Yeah, it's so cute too when you see them, like, you know, they puff their neck out and everything, and I'm like, oh, he's trying hard, look at him go.
You know, maybe this is a connection. There was someone that wrote me earlier in the day about and I guess this can piggyback from our old show tattooing, but the use
there you
of
go,
paints
yeah.
paints right body paint
right
Like, what did that symbolize? That's actually the question. What did that symbolize? The different body paints and stuff like that. The different colors, I should say. Like the red is.
The red, the black, and the white are what I see a lot, at least nowadays. It's funny because when we were doing our show about, body modification tattoos, I was looking at that, and I was trying to figure out what, like, each color specifically represented. But they were talking more about, like, you know, body paint was more of a status symbol or to show somebody was a Bajique or a Cacique. But I guess it was really hard to kind of just, like, break down, okay, but why this specific color or why this specific design? Mm-hmm. And I've seen some theories, you know, they say red represents the sun and the dawn and the black represents night, which makes sense, right? But those are just educated guesses. It's hard to, I think, figure out exactly break down exactly what it meant, but it is pretty consistent in the coloring and the pattern. You know, we always have stuff under the eyes or across the eyes in a band. We like to do like dots, like those dots under the eyes. That's a really good question. And I wish I had the answer, but I don't. I just have the theories that I've heard.
I remember many years ago, back in the 90s, we were at a powwow in Pennsylvania. I was with Nación Taína, and Sibanacan was the chief. And it was a whole bunch of us who were dancing, right? We were like gung-ho, you know? So we pee in our faces and everything. So when we came to the dance circle, typical Native humor, one dancer was like, hey, here comes Taino Kiss. Because I guess we overdid our face.
Was it that much? Yeah, wow. You must have put a lot on then.
Oh, we had some symbols going on. I think I had some lightning bolts going on. And my boy Condor. My boy Condor had a condor painted on his face. And they're like, hey, this Taino Kiss is here. And we all look at each other like, damn, that's messed up.
They want to rock and roll all night, party every day.
Yeah, man. So I think I still have a photo of a face. One of the
original. Yeah, you bet. You got to send me that. That sounds really funny.
Yeah, I want to post it on Taino Radio. It's back circa 1994 when I got my tribal card from Taino Nation.
That's a throwback.
But I look at it now. I'm like, what was I thinking? Like, it looked like a galaxy. I think like literally a galaxy. It's like the Milky Way.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, it's funny, like, when people don't remember, when people are trying to, like I said, with regalia or with face paint, with whatever, it's hard to keep things exactly the way they were hundreds of years ago, right? Because either people don't remember or it's just we've changed and moved on so much. So people will like a lot of stuff is being invented and reinvented, right? People will sort of kind of like the language, like we reconstruct it with what we have, you know, like there's no necessarily one right way to do it. We just go by the information we have. And it was funny that I remember even seeing, if you've ever seen the movie Wind River, very, you know, somber, sad movie about missing and murdered Indigenous women. Very good movie, very important, I think, to see. But I remember after, you know, the main character who was murdered, later on her father is sitting outside and he's wearing, like, some paint on his face. And, he says, this is my death face. And he said, and one guy goes, oh, really? He goes, yeah, but I kind of had to make it up because there's no one left to teach it anymore. And so he literally kind of just made it up himself and then later at one point, he says, all right, guess I better go and wash this shit off my face or something.
Oh my God, you're kidding me.
Yeah. So it was just like, you know, it looked like it meant something, but like, when the guy, he said, this is my death mask or something. And he goes, well, I kind of just made it up because there's no one around to teach it. And, you know, it was sort of funny, but at the same time, it's sad because he's making a real point, right? That there is no one left to teach it because people have been forced to forget, or a lot of it has been forgotten, or, you know, so much of it was taken away that there is no one around to tell you exactly how it would have been, right?
Yeah. You know, that's a good point, because I know in the Crow Nation, they had lost their Sundance, and that's when I mentioned this before on the show, how Chief, Ceremonial Chief, Medicine Man, Thomas Yellowtail, he went to the Shoshones because they historically were allies, and they went to the Shoshones and they asked them if they could teach them the Sundance.
Sundance, yeah.
And they did. So when you go to a Crow Sundance, it's really a Shoshone Sundance. So it seems like a lot of the northern tribes, they do this. It's not that they borrow, but they're given the rights. And that's one thing I think Taino movement has not done well at, like seeking that help or seeking that guidance. You know, I mean, I love it. I do it all the time, but it seems like overall.
I talk to anyone from Lucayan or other Arawakan tribes, especially because they're our closest, relative, right?
Yeah. I know what I do. I do these naming ceremonies. I've been doing it for several years because I experienced an Andean from Ecuador, a traditional naming ceremony, and I loved it. And I was like, wow, what a ceremony where you're invited into the community and the community decides, like, your name. And it's really powerful. So what I did was I learned it, but I modified it too, to make it more my own.
And
I always see that this is not a traditional naming ceremony, but it's something that I was inspired, by the Andean people. But, I guess symbols are powerful. Ceremonial symbols are powerful.
Especially when you get to that point, right, where we're sharing our symbols with other tribes who maybe haven't been as fortunate to still have theirs or who have lost or forgotten theirs. And then they become even more powerful because there's more people who stand behind them, right? Like, one thing I'm thinking of is the medicine wheel, the with the four colors and the four corners. I mean, that historically came from one specific nation, but now, I mean, it's become like a pan-Indian or like every tribe knows the medicine wheel, right? We all know what it means. We all stand behind it. It's very associated with American Indian culture in general, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know I had a discourse with someone who tried to criticize our flag, the Arayaki flag, because they said, this is a Lakota flag, but, sarcastically. I mean, no, it's our flag. I mean, we had Deminan, the four brothers, four directions. Like, hey, we got a right to use four directions, too,
the colors is very associated with multiple tribes, like I said, so it's not like it specifically just belongs to the Lakota or whoever. I mean, many of the indigenous cultures, pretty much almost all of them, acknowledge the four directions and four color, and some slight variation maybe, but it's still the same concept, right?
Yeah, exactly. The first time I had a friend many years ago from South Africa. And when she invited me to the home, she had a collection of beaded work. And I was like, oh, man, where you got these? From the Lakotas? The Navajo? I say, oh, no, South Africa. I'm like, what? I'm like, oh. So their beadwork is, I compare it equal to, the plains, it's like, or the Navajo beadworks. So it's like, hey, man, it's universal beadwork
Well, especially when you think about how much interaction there was between people, right? Like, again, so many African people were brought over to the islands during the slave trade and shared ideas and concepts, right? And then some of them went back or word of mouth spread back home. And so it goes back to what we were talking about before, about the idea of like admixing of cultures and creating something new and unique by bringing in elements from other cultures, and it doesn't make it any less authentic. It's just the nature of how culture works. Culture is alive and changing and growing and moving. It's not static. It doesn't stay the same.
Yeah, I think unfortunately a lot of people make this mistake, and I made this long time ago, and sometimes I still do, where we glorify our ancestors and make them like, you know, back then historically, we make them like gods, like little g, you know, and
right.
They were human just like us. They were human beings, and they experimented. And I could just imagine the adaptation they needed to do, you know, to adapt and to, you know,
to survive,
to take
right?
certain things, adapt certain things to survive, exactly. So,
yeah.
Wow.
And we did.
The human, it's the human nature, and then create new symbols, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, well, like, even you go to powwows, you see, you know, these women with their cloth dresses and men with the cloth shirts and stuff. Obviously, back in, you know, the original day, they wouldn't have been wearing that fabric. You know, they didn't have that kind of fabric in the prior to contact for a lot of people, at least among the Eastern Woodland tribes. But now, you know, those ribbon shirts and ribbon dresses have become so quintessentially associated with powwow regalia. Even though that was technically a colonial introduction, right? Because they wouldn't have had like silk or satin for ribbons before then.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's that famous Sammy from Italy, Rome. From my family is bad. The Nazionale Preistorico ed Etnografico. The Luigi Licorini, they call it, that's what they call it, Luigi Licorini. I guess he was the owner of it.
Yeah,
and,
that's what I was going to say. That sounds like a name.
Yeah, I remember I actually went to a lecture in Museo del Barrio, and I actually got to see it. It was on loan. And to Semi, the front part's a human face. And
oh, it's and
beaded.
It's a skull on a skeleton on the other side?
Right, it's a human and skeleton in the back.
Right. I love that thing. It's so cool.
Right. So I remember it was discovered in Dominican Republic.
Right.
18th century. It's made out of wood, cotton, shell, and glass. Now,
that's
I remember
right.
The
it's
guy
amazing.
The guy that studied that for me, and there's also a belt. Okay, a belt also associated with it. They kind of looks like Atabe because it has the hands up or it has the earplugs, you know, with the teeth. Actually, it's like
right.
one of those bats.
Looking
you know?
It up right
but,
now. Cause...
Yeah, and it has glass. But he was telling us that the glass in the belt and also on the semi, the earrings, the plugs, they're Venetian glass. Venetian glass. Which is, I guess,
which
Italian
would have
glass.
Come from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The beads were actually European glass beads. The designs are actually traditional African designs. They're not even Taino designs. They're African. The face material is actually rhinoceros. From a rhinoceros horn.
That's crazy.
The eyes, the white part of the eyes is, I think, from the elephant, the tusk. Tusk, I can't remember the
tusk, yeah.
Tusk, right. Yeah. And so talk about syncretism there, right? And this was
yeah.
made by our ancestors post-invasion.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
but
and it's such an amazing piece. Mm-hmm. I love, like,
yeah.
Look, I remember that was one of the first semis I ever saw, and it affected me so much because it was like this symbol of, like, you know, how close life and death are. That's how I took it, at least,
yeah.
You know, like on the one side you have the living person, and then the other side you have the skeleton. It's like this
yeah.
symbol, again, we go back to symbols of how death is always with us, with all of us, and
mm-hmm.
none of us are really that far from it ever. And, you know, we're all going to die, and it's not something
mm-hmm.
we should be afraid of, but rather to embrace as a part of who we are
mm-hmm.
as humans, right? I always
mm-hmm.
just thought it was so amazing. Like,
well, here's the thing that did not impress me about the lecture. I forget the guy's name. My God, let me see if I can find it. But he
Luigi something or other.
Let me see. I'm trying to see. But see the belt. It was from circa 1530. That's what it was. Yep, 1530.
Right, so that's close contact by a lot, right?
And that belt is in Vienna, that belt, the Museum für Volkenkunde, I guess German, Vienna. So, and it had the same...
Austria.
And it had the same designs as that, to me, with the human and the skull, had the same designs. And they trace it to Africa, those designs. So you have European beads, Italian glass, African design, with Taino worldview, right?
Right.
So this is 1530. So something was happening that was kind of powerful.
Yeah, I mean, talk about syncretism and cultural syncretism. I mean, that. You know, so that was what, at least 50 years, 50 or 60 years post-contact.
Right.
So kind of close to original contact, but we were already at that point incorporating elements and styles and materials, obviously, from all over the world.
Right.
And I think this sort of goes back to, you know, we talked about food last week. And how our food made its way to Europe, right, and became such a big part of a lot of European cuisine. And that works both ways because, look, like our food got to Europe and then, like, a lot of their materials got to us and became part of our tangible cultural heritage, right? We use it. And it's you know, there is nothing wrong with that because that's what a lot of people did. I mean – even those those jingle dresses, beautiful as they are, and you know, they definitely, you know, have a much older origin date in terms of the tradition. But the bells, once they used to be made out of shell or whatever raw materials could be found, but once post contact and when they were introduced to tin and metal, all those bells. Were made of that because it was easier, right? And it worked better and it made the noises better. And now every jingle dress you see will be made like that, and that doesn't make it any less authentic, right?
Well, this is what the natives use, right? The foundation is dance, spiritual dance. That's the foundation, right? The drum, the dance,
right.
The rhythm. But the what do you call it, the effects, you know, sound, beauty, you know, they made it real, right? They made it their own, and that's all
right. Yeah, you can change. I mean, if some material works better than another or is easier or, you know, more economically friendly to get and use, yeah, it's as long as the original meaning is still there, I think it doesn't, you know, it shouldn't matter what it's made of or who they got it from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trade's been around for forever.
well, I find it interesting that in the Agua Dulce, the 21 divisions in the Dominican Republic, that they use the indigenous spirits or the ancestors. They say they used to use rattles, but now they use bells. So whenever they speak of the mysteries of the spirits, the ancestors, they ring a bell. But back in the day, it was rattles.
Right.
And, you know, again, you know, adopting the style of that people. Or in San Juan and Maguana, they use bells instead of rattles. So that's, you know, things evolve, right? But the building is still the same. Honoring, right? Honor. You honor.
Of course. Right.
Right.
That's what I think people don't realize, you know. People say, oh, that's not authentic because it's not this way or that way. And I've always been of the opinion that, again, trade is one of the oldest human practices of all time. People were always trading within their own continents and with other continents. So even if the materials come from somewhere else, it doesn't matter. It's still, you make it your own based on what you put it towards, what use you put it towards. And even with exchanging traditions, you know, right? Like a friend of mine who is Haudenosaunee, so Oneida specifically, that's more commonly known as Iroquois. She gave me a ribbon shirt, a very beautiful, and white, beautiful ribbon shirt. So because she noticed, you know, a lot of my regalia as a Taino is white. That's what I kind of tend to go with. She gave me this beautiful ribbon shirt, and I almost kind of felt bad for me because I said, do I have a right to wear this? Because historically, we didn't wear ribbon shirts. My people didn't wear ribbon shirts. But then she told me, she said, well, we wear, you know, woven cloth, which we didn't have historically either. So why can't you wear a ribbon shirt as long as, you know, you wear it like at a powwow and you wear it with the proper intentions and everything. Like there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, we do that all the time. And I've noticed over the last few powwows I've gone to, especially that how often people do that, like adapt from other tribes, other traditions. I remember even at the Pottstown powwow, there was this one girl who was a jingle dancer, and she's beautiful, and she's, you know, dancing, has a beautiful jingle dress. So, of course, I'm assuming she's got to be like Ojibwa or Chippewa, you know, something from one of those nations where the jingle dress originated. And then she comes up to me, and she goes, oh, are you Taino? She recognizes, you know, some, again, my symbols from my regalia. And I said, oh, yeah, Are you Chippewa or Ojibwe? And she goes, no, I'm Taino as well. And I said, really? And then she like pointed to her belt. She had her dad had made her this you know, beaded emblem with a koki on it, which I hadn't even noticed before. And so she had this jingle dress, but she just put this koki emblem on it and was wearing it. And I said, oh, so are you just got into jingle dance? And she said, yeah, I know. You know, we didn't do it historically, but I really love it, and I appreciate, you know, the meaning behind it, the beauty and the music of it as a young woman and a young indigenous woman. And so I just, you know, I wear the jingle dress, but I still like to add my own Taino symbols in there just so people know that even though I'm dancing this tradition that's not necessarily my own, I'm still representing my own people through it. And I thought that was really, like, that really taught me so much, you know, because here I'm thinking, like, why would you wear something from a completely different tribe if you're not from that tribe? But it made sense, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And look, you look at our ancestors, right? The stuff they brought from the mainland, which are South America or Central America, you know, up north, Mexico region, you know, look at the symbol of the Maya Huacan, right? The Maya Huacan. We can do a whole show on that because the Mexicas, Aztec people, they have the symbol of Maya Huacan, you know?
Right.
You know, so we can go on, like, theorizing where did it come from? Did it come from South America, the Maya Huacan, right? These big, huge drums they make out of wood. So did it originate from the Caribbean or did it originate from South America, you know, the migrations and all that? So I'm telling you, we brought so much with us, so much influences. The aguacate, like we're talking about the food, right? That's another thing. A lot of people consider aguacate a symbol of Caribbean cuisine, right? The avocado, but it comes from Mexico, right?
Comes from Mexico, The word avocado, I think, is even a Nahuatl or Aztec language word.
So we do it with the food, we do it with the music, ceremonies, the DMT, the Yopo, the Cohoba, right? That comes from South America, indigenous to South America. And we brought that over. Wow, it's a lot of, you know what's cool? I want to ask you about this because I have experience, personal experience, using the different medicines like ayahuasca, Cohoba, and I see the same symbols that I see on the pottery. I see it. I used to see it in my visions or when I would do a ceremony with DMT. I see the same images, the triangles, the circles, the interacting, geometrical designs. I see it all. I see it all over the artifacts. I see it in the semis. I see it, you know. So it's like those are powerful symbols of ceremonial experiences, right? Like, what do you think about
right.
that? It's all over, you know.
Yeah, it's yeah, and you. I mean, like some. That's why I was talking. You know, when I first started this, I said some symbols are universal in mm-hmm. across the world, right? Like, I mean, the one thing I always mm-hmm. think of with Taino culture is spirals, right? Like there's so many petroglyphs we see with those spiral designs. And there's a lot in Cubao, especially in a lot of the caves down there. And mm-hmm. some people, there's been kind of mixed review on what it symbolizes. Some people say water. Some people say hurricane, mm-hmm. Hurricanes, which mm-hmm. kind of goes hand in hand, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, spiral symbols are everywhere. You'll see them in Europe. You'll see them in Africa. I mean, that design, those geometric shapes, I think it's because humans are naturally drawn to symmetrical, you know, pretty looking things made of like basic shapes like that, right? You know, like even as small children, mm-hmm. our first toys we're given are like shapes, right? Circle, square, star. Mm-hmm. That's the first things we learn. And so for it to be across multiple cultures, a design that gets used in a lot of different ways, be it through art, through religion, through ceremony, through a symbolism of whatever it's meant to be, it's a lot of the designs we see are similar. The other one we're talking about is those for Hiwayawa specifically, our nagua that we wear, the border has those kind of square spiral designs, which
right.
turned up in a lot of petroglyphic art and everything. But we see a ton mm-hmm. of those in Greco-Roman culture too. So like ancient Greece mm-hmm. and Rome, you see those same exact type of designs. And so I think that's really cool that because it kind of just speaks more to like our connection as humans and what we find meaningful, you know, in some basic shapes that we mm-hmm. see either in nature or in our own imagination.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so important. Oh man, you just made me think about how about this symbol? It's all over Taino art, and it embarrasses a lot of conservative people. It's filled with phallic symbols. fertility, right? Look at Atabe, right in the middle.
Yeah,
you see
vagina.
Then you got.
I love
you know,
how you
thing
whispered when you said.
I know, right?
There's a vagina.
I don't know if we got some conservative audience listening. I don't know from.
I mean, it's not like you said it could have been worse.
yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, definitely, right? Like the, yeah, exactly. So, man, so that's the thing. Well, and you need to say the phallic symbol connected with the breasts, you know, and it's like, I love that piece. That it's like that vase that has the penis in the middle, then it has the breast on the side, and it's a water
right.
vessel. I guess. But, I mean, that's amazing what they were doing. This whole, again, that dualism, right? So.
Yeah, male,
you know,
female, and fertility, and yeah, exactly.
Yeah, do you see that in other cultures, like Greece, Rome? Like,
oh,
do you have that dualism with the sexual dualism,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Again, it was Christianity more that kind of came and shut that all down because obviously the Christian idea was, you know, modesty and everything sexual or physical, anything related to the body was naughty, right? That was demonic. That was associated with paganism and primal needs. And Christianity was so conservative, right? That's whereas our people, you know, and a lot of non-European indigenous people, like the concept of nudity and wasn't a thing for us. Like I said, like our ancestors were very little. Women walked around with their breasts out. It wasn't a thing, you know. Their breasts were a part of anatomy. It was normal. Men had their junk out too, and again, it wasn't anything frowned upon. It wasn't anything scandalous. And yeah, if you look at, I'm trying to remember. So in a lot of pre, you know, Atabe, especially that symbol we're all classically associated with of her, with like her legs spread and her breasts and everything.
Right.
That's a very shows up in many, many cultures. Like obviously a woman, and especially like a pregnant woman or a fertile looking woman, is the most, you know, the best symbol of fertility you can have, because women are associated with the earth, which is why we always say there's a concept of an earth mother who gives birth to all our crops, all our plants, all our animals. But even if you look back at a lot of the even prehistoric, like Paleolithic caves, they found those. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. Those little Venus figures, they're called, of women with like a woman figurine. It's very basic. They don't have faces or anything, but they just have these really large hanging breasts, large kind of bellies, like looking pregnant.
Yes.
So, and that is like that is prehistoric times people were making these. So they were recognizing the importance of the female form, at least, especially with in relation to fertility and to, you know, being able to keep crops growing, keep animals coming. And even in pagan cultures across Europe, you'll see these figurines all the time. In fact, in Ireland, there's these figures called in Gaelic, it's Sheila Nagi, which roughly translates to, again, my Gaelic is a little off, but it roughly translates to women. Woman figure, basically. And what they are is, on all these churches and cathedrals, it's these kind of more basic, more almost like primitive prehistoric little carvings of these female figures with literally their hands down in their vaginas holding them open. And these would be put on churches, like a symbol of Christianity, but they would be carved into the, you know, you wouldn't notice unless you looked really close, but along with like gargoyles and everything, and a lot of Irish churches, and I've seen them, they're right there too. The Sheila and Nagi are everywhere, and what people believe is that it's a combination of like this survival of this, you know, pre-Christian pagan Celtic goddess, and the concept of, because fertility is such an important concept, right, for any human being, especially in that days, to be able to survive, you needed the earth and everything around you to be fertile, considered a fertility figure. And then other hypotheses are that it is a sort of like a protection against evil or something, and it's supposed to like kind of scare off anything evil, like with these women with these their giant open vaginas that they're holding open. And also it's supposed to, ironically enough, sometimes also be a protection against the concept of lust, by using like what could be associated as a lustful figure to actually ward off lust within the church. But it's amazing how common they are. Not just in, I mean, Ireland is what kind of coined them, but they come up with, churches and old cathedrals and monasteries all over Europe have them. And a lot of people believe it does harken back originally to a pagan fertility goddess that, you know, even though people converted to Christianity at the time in Europe, they didn't quite drop everything from before, right? It's you know, people think of a conversion is like, it's like a one and done quick, you know, flip a switch. It's really not, you know, there's so many concepts of the ancient religion and the ancient beliefs that kind of seeped their way into Christianity.
Well, I remember when I was studying for the priesthood, Roman Catholic priesthood, I remember I had to take a lot of early church history, also liturgy classes and the history of the liturgy and the Christian tradition. And I remember they were saying that the early church, the first generation of Christians were Jewish. And, you know, a lot of them became kind of, what's that word? Basically, okay, Jesus is not coming back, so let's just abandon this whole idea, you know, of Messiah or whatever. So then a lot of their leaders that still held on to the belief that Jesus is going to come back, they went to the Greco-Roman world, and what they did was they adopted those ceremonies into the liturgy, into those early ceremonies, and it's still used now. I remember as a kid, I used to love this. The Paschal candle during the Easter vigil, in which they take the candle, the long candle, the Paschal candle, used for baptisms, they use for weddings.
Right.
And they mark off the four directions. The four directions, right? They mark it off.
Yeah.
And they take
the
candle and they dunk it in the water, in a pail of water. They dunk it four times. Bam, bam, bam. And they light a fire before that, you know? And I remember reading in the liturgy, in liturgy class, that that's taken from the Greco-Roman, the temple rituals. And what it is, the candle is the penis, the phallic.
Right.
And dunking into the water, that's the vagina. And you do it four times, the four directions, you know. It's bringing new life.
Yeah.
So Easter is bringing new life, right? Jesus is the new life, the new way, right? The new path. Right? The way.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
Bam. But that's the only way they were able to get converts, you know, by using
right.
the rituals.
Again.
Yeah,
because yeah, like I said, when you're converting people from paganism, you know, what they've been believing for hundreds of thousands of years to something so new and completely different, it's hard to sell that on just saying, okay, forget everything you knew, right, and do this instead. Mm-hmm. And now they're just saying, okay, well, do this, but I guess you can keep doing that, right? Or, you know, you can still worship your gods, but instead call them Saint whoever and Saint whoever, you know? It was not a quick slapdash conversion like people often think it was. And a lot of people did continue carrying on their original traditions because that was the easiest way to get converts, like you said. Something, if there was something they could relate to, you know, of course they're going to convert much better than if you just say, you know, forget everything you know and do this instead. And you talked about, you know, the phallic symbols again, and yeah, that shows up everywhere. The basic symbol for masculinity and man it looks like basically a triangle, like pointed upwards. It's called the blade. It's meant to be, you know, a symbol of strength, of bravery, but it also is a phallic symbol, right? So it's associated very deeply with masculinity. It's used in military decor and a lot of other such symbols, of police decor as well. And then the opposite of it is that same symbol reversed, which is more like a flipped upside down triangle or a V shape, which is more associated with female because it's the shape of a female womb, which again is a symbol of fertility. So that phallic symbol though is everywhere in ancient culture, in Greco-Roman culture, in Egyptian and all of Western European history. You'll see it even like weaponry. The shapes of knives, of blades, that's all kind of been associated as being quintessentially masculine or phallic in a way with that
right.
shape. And right. even nowadays, some people say guns and firearms are kind of that new phallic symbol because, you know, not only do they have a similar shape, like being that kind of long, again, phallic symbol, but now they're the new weapon of choice associated with masculinity, with strength. And all, if you look at ancient art and depictions of gods of war and gods of fertility gods as well, any god associated with those original kind of, like I said, quintessentially masculine qualities usually will be depicted with nude or enough where you at least see, you know, his penis and everything. And that was part of it, right? I mean, a lot of the, in Greco-Roman art, you'll see it all the time. a lot of warriors in ancient in the ancient world, especially throughout Greece, Rome, and parts of Africa, would fight completely in the nude. Celts as well, the ancient Celtic warriors, and even a lot of the Nordic warriors itself, the men would fight completely nude because, again, this was a symbol of their strength, of their masculinity. They didn't need armor. And having their you know, their penis exposed gave them power in a sense, or in a symbolic sense or ritualistic sense, at least, you know, because that was the source of it for them as men, as warriors.
It was interesting. I remember taking ancient Hebrew Bible, you know, understanding it, they call it Hebrew scriptures, right? And I remember the lecturer was saying that the religion of the Bible, the scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, is different from what people were practicing. And I remember we had to study the prophets, and one of the famous prophets was Nehemiah, right? And when you read Nehemiah, he's always attacking the people, like, you know, you idolatry, you know, the abomination, you know, it's always attacking the people for worshiping idols, you know, it was a big no-no.
Right.
And I remember him teaching us that. It was always that struggle between the prophets, who were really in the minority compared to the majority of the people, what they were practicing. And like 6 years later, I still remember this. There was a, I forget what town in Israel, but they found a major preserved village, like homes of a village in Israel that dates around that time of the prophets. Every home had a sculpture of what you were saying, the woman with the big breasts and the big belly and the fertility goddess, you know. Every
right.
home had one. So this is what the prophets were fighting about, you know. They saw it as idol worship. It's not God, you know.
Right.
It's not the God, the one God, right? Moses,
right, but we know that this is very different, right?
And that was the proof. I remember the lecturer kept saying, the professor, like, yeah, man, this is a clear clue that the people were practicing something that was the norm. And these prophets were not the norm. They were like, you know, like the ultra-conservative, you know?
Sure,
and
yeah.
Bam, the proof came out. They found this village in Israel.
Roman Catholicism, which claims to be, you know, Christian and follows all the rules of you know, the Hebrew God, do not worship idols, do not worship any gods other than me. But one could argue that their veneration of saints and, you know, relics associated with saints, statues and, you know, pictures and sculptures or which exist, right? Especially in, you know, Latin American culture, we see those all the time. A lot of people have argued, is that not the same thing? Is that not the worship of idols? Is that not akin to worshiping any god other than yourself? You know, we're venerating saints as if they are at least somewhat divine, right? We pray, we can pray to saints, we can venerate saints. So, well, what makes them different is what a lot of people say. And the reason it's called Roman Catholicism is because it comes out, the first guy to convert, Constantine, was Roman. So he injected a lot of his, in my opinion, old Roman idea, pagan Roman ideas into this new Christian religion, and it has survived up until modern day.
And here's the thing. Why do human beings throughout history create these I want to say the word idols, but create these sculptures, right? It's a teaching tool, right? It reminds us what
we're visual creatures.
Yeah, it's visual. It teaches. And I know in the medieval times there was a lot of illiteracy, and these saints was a teaching tool, you know, to teach virtues, to teach certain virtues. How do we know that our ancestors, the Caribbean indigenous, would bury their semi, the Yucahu semi, and they would urinate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you know that? It was recorded, right, by De La Casas,
right.
Who,
right.
You know, there were some Tainos that were given what do you call it, that we're giving saints to venerate. Like, forget those semis. This is the true faith, right? And
right.
They buried those saints, and they urinated on them. You know.
That's right, and everyone was like, what are you doing?
So we're like, all right, cool, man, all right. These look pretty cool, and they buried them.
Yeah,
so,
right? But
the
then, you know,
symbol.
Of course, other people were like, what are you doing? You can't do that. Like, but, yeah,
yeah,
it was, again, semis, gods, spirits, whatever you want to call it. With Catholicism, I think why so many people were able, you know, Catholicism was the first form of Christianity there was before the Protestant Reformation and the Protestants broke off. And I think the reason it was so easily able, you know, Catholics were so easily able to convert a lot of non-Christians was because the saint tradition closely emulated a lot of the original traditions that non-Christian people had, because a lot of non-Christian people were polytheistic is the word, you know, they worshiped multiple gods or spirits or semi or orisha, whatever you want to call them. And so when the Catholics introduced the idea of, okay, yeah, there's one big supreme God, but then there's also saints, a lot of people said, okay, yeah, that's kind of like us, right? We have like one big guy in charge, but then there's lots of others representing different things. So that we can jive with a little more, right? And then the Protestant Reformation, though, on the other hand, kind of rejected all that because it was them who said what I mentioned before, saying like, well, wait a minute, how is worshiping saints any different than worshiping another god other than the one supreme guy? You know, that they believe that's not what God meant when he said, don't worship any god other than me, don't worship idols, etc. And that's why they broke off, and that is the main difference between the two. Many other things as well, but that was one of the big ones. But that's a harder concept to sell, isn't it?
Well, I remember the second time I had an ayahuasca ceremony, right? And it blew me away because everything I learned about theology, about God, whatever, you know, it's just, wow, it just blew me away. There's no language to describe this, but, you know, you see all these geometrical designs. You see, it was broken into little parts, you know, like little segments, maybe a circle here, triangle, rectangle, all broken. Like, it was like when you throw a glass, it shatters, like, you know. And then all of a sudden, little by little, right in front of me, all these little pieces became one. And then they separated a little again, and you see all these different colors. And you hear the rattle in the background singing, the medicine man was singing. Then it comes back again. Then it breaks apart again. And then it comes back together again. And I just, like, fell in love with that. Like, oh, my God, this is, like, beautiful. This is, like, the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. In my understanding, listening to all the lectures and my own faith experience, this is God. I'm looking at God, like, God is everywhere. God is everything. God is the littlest piece. You can, the littlest atom, you know. But when you put it together, there's a human being, you know. And then you got the planet. Then you got the galaxies, the planets. It's like, whoa. It's like, it's all many, but it's one. And I remember, like, that blew me away, like, so I can see these semis, these multiple, like, 12 major semis, but it's all one for me. That's why I need to say, this is all one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put all the pieces together, click them, bam, 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 you know? And
exactly.
Wow. It's like, all right, the ancient ones, they got it, you know, they got it, and they got it through nature, these plants, plant medicines, right? It's like they didn't have any libraries. You know?
Right, exactly. But, yeah, that was how you learned and taught back then. And like you said, we're visual people. So every time, yes. So using, you know, again, you use the term idols, which seems like a negative, but it wasn't. It was just, how do we teach, especially like children, about this concept? It was what you do, right? It's,
yeah,
you know, there's nothing wrong with having some sort of physical representation of something, and that that at its core and basic, most basic definition, that's what a symbol is, right? It's a physical representation of a larger, more abstract concept is what I would describe it as. And that is how we as humans have always communicated through symbols, you know, and then there's variation throughout. Yeah. So it all, it's cool how that all came full circle, right?
You know, many years ago, no, not many years ago, his name was the Birdman of Inwood. We became good friends, and he was autistic, but he was a genius. He worked for NASA. He worked for Wall Street, you know, creating softwares, but never graduated college. Never graduated college, so. But he
probably didn't need to.
Yep. Yeah, he was a mathematical genius. And one day, once we became, you know, good buddies, he's like, Lou, I got proof of God. I have proof. And I'm like, really? Yeah, I have proof who God is. So he says, I trust you. I'm going to show it to you. And it's all through equations. I'm like, all right, cool. So he showed me all these equations. It was crazy. It's like out of a sci-fi movie, right? And then when,
I'm terrible at math.
No, it was all in the notebook, all these equations, right? Bah, 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 bah. And then finally he showed me the last piece of the equation. It turned into a circle. It was like a circle.
What?
These equations turned into a circle. And he says, this is God. God's a circle.
Like the answers to the equation turned into a circle?
It turned into, you know, you had all these, you know, it was like lineal, you know, square root,
yeah,
blah, 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 blah. It was all,
right,
and then
right,
towards the end, as he's getting the answers, as the answers of, and he says, this is what I do to create software. And then at the end, it was a circle. It turned into a circle.
That's crazy, dude. That would blow my mind.
Yeah, so he's got a different brain wavelength, whatever, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, people who are brilliant like that, I give them so much credit. I mean, again, I always sucked at math. I still suck at math. I never understood, you know, the concept of equations and numbers. I was like, nope, this is not, I don't get it. It makes no sense to me. It's nothing I could ever relate to. But what you just said right now, I mean, that I can relate to. Like, if someone were to show me that and say, look, it creates a circle, you know, I can see what's in front of me, and I would be like, my mind would be blown at that. I would never figure it out on my own, nor would I ever figure it out without someone to explain it to me, but.
Yeah, and he said it took him years to figure this out, because he was working with prime numbers, he was doing all this computer math stuff. But what he was saying is that this math is ancient. It's like, you know, geometrical, they call it geometrical math, whatever. And
we'll
the thing was that
basic shapes, right?
Yeah, but each page, as he was doing the equation, I saw his work, would change, like it would move almost like into these geometrical designs. But at the end, when he solved the problem, it was a circle. I'm like, what the hell? So then I said,
that's
dude,
one
this
of
is
our most basic symbols, right?
Yeah, and I said, dude, this is what the ancients, the indigenous peoples talk about right now. And life is a circle, you know, movement. And he was just so happy that he made that connection, because he didn't know like that deep, you know.
Yeah,
like,
no,
wow.
Good for him.
Yeah, and then Yeah, eventually he died of sack. The work that he was doing, he was pretty much poisoning himself to death, you know, the stuff he was working on the environment. And, man, I tell you, it was sad. But, you know, symbols, right? Again, numbers.
Yeah, but, right, numbers.
And
the circle, I feel like that's our most, as human beings, that's like our most of any kind of symbol, our most basic understanding of circle, of something being cyclical, because cyclical implies that things just keep going on and on, right? And that's exactly what life was. Like, even our earliest ancestors could see that everything, there was no stop and start. start, you know, it was all connected. Something would happen and that would lead to something else, which would lead to something else. You know, the cycle of birth and death, the cycle of, you know, the seasons, of the calendar days, of the years. It was all like people, no. I think that's why that concept of the circle is so primordial to us, right? Because we could recognize that, like, a circle has no end. And that's why, you know, even the concept of wedding rings are a ring for a reason, because it's meant to symbolize this is a bond and love that has no end. It's cyclical. It goes on forever. And we use circles for the medicine. You know, circles come up in everything, literally. And of course, they're also the shape of our world and our planet and the sun and the moon. Everything that's important to us is a circle, right?
Now, check this out. I'm going to add some the opposite of that, the contrast, Wayne. Are you ready for this?
Oh, boy.
Are you still ready for this? Get ready for this. You're going to...
Okay,
you share with me your gut feeling on this, or thoughts. I used to be a security guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I remember this artist. He used to come every Monday. He had a little stool, and his talent or his gift was... If you take a sculpture and you put it in a Xerox machine, it'll give you a perfect image, right? Like, you know, this is from the copy machine, right? That's how good he was. He can do a copy image of a sculpture or whatever, right? And one day I asked him if he can teach me his technique, you know? He was a very open guy. He was a very lovely man. And he says, oh, yes, you always have to start with a rectangle. I'm like, rectangle? He says, yes.
What?
The world is composed of rectangles. I'm like, what? So you will see all these rectangles. He'll draw all these rectangles. He'll look at the space, you know, he'll look at the object, and he'll start doing all these rectangles. Eventually, those rectangles will turn into circles. I don't know how he did it, but he did it a certain way. Those rectangles turn into circles. And right now, I'll quiz you right now. Right in front of you, look at an object right now. Look at an object. Do you have an object
in
front of you?
My phone, which is a rectangle. Yeah, my phone's a rectangle.
There you go. Yeah, you look at your computer screen. That's a good, you know. Even if you look at something round, you can do rectangles, you know. But the rectangle is like a four directions, eight directions, turns into a rectangle, right? I mean, it turns into a circle. So this is how he did it. And at the end, it was a perfect image of, you know, whatever. If you look at the bates, right, in Puerto Rico,
right,
or Dominican Republic, Cuba, they're rectangles. Now, there's one that's in Tibes, the one in Tibes, which I think Huaya was sponsoring a seminar today. But
yeah, that's right.
There's a round one, right? But it's not a bate. That was a sundial. That was a sun, I think you call it a sundial or a sun... whatever, to measure
the
sun.
Mm-hmm. No, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, sundial.
It wasn't about this. So guess what? The rectangle, man. Our people knew about the rectangle, the importance of the rectangle. So I believe, my opinion from that artist, the rectangle, when you break a circle apart, you get the rectangle. You understand? So I think the bate was breaking everything down to the simplicity of life. My opinion, I didn't write the book yet on this, but so yeah, you look at your credit card, you look at your anything. It's a rectangle. Flag, notebook, pillow, bed.
Yeah.
It's not about a rectangle.
No, you're right. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about that before. And it is, but again, like, I guess it goes back to, I mean, I could say the same about a triangle, you know. There's so many, we look at triangular shapes for, like, business models, you know, food and nutrition, pyramids, things that, or, like, anything that's reflected as, like, a ray of light. It's just, like, I guess I would modify to say, like, those basic shapes, again, that we learn as small children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are the foundation of so much of our symbolic understanding as humans, right? Because they're so ingrained in us and we can all recognize it. And again, even I said those, you know, those basic male female symbols are both rectangle or both triangles, but just reversed. One is points up, the other points down, but it's still the same basic symbol, right?
Yeah. So I think my theory is, I think our people definitely took these symbols seriously and they broke it down. Those symbols is like breaking down God, you know, like breaking it down. And you put it all together, you have life force, right? You got male, female, life, death. Because our people saw the Opias as living beings, not like us, you know, but they were alive. They were a person.
Yeah.
So, man, I'm telling you.
The sun is always a symbol of life, you notice? Like, we have, like, the Hayuya sun and so many other variations of sun designs in the Taino petroglyphs and everything, like from different regions, because the sun is always associated with life or being part of that fertility process, right? And then kind of in a sort of reverse, what's always associated with death? It's a skull or a skeleton, right? Skeletal features like on that semi, like what we see in even like Day of the Dead concepts or warnings against poisonous substances. It's always, you know, that skull and that the skeletal figure is always the Grim Reaper, everything that's always associated with death.
Exactly. But there's life in that, you know, so.
Right. It's a cycle. It's a circle, remember?
Yeah, see, that's the key, the cycle, you know, it's not linear, it's definitely like constant
it's
movement,
not linear,
right?
Yeah.
It goes around and around and around.
It does, in my opinion, at least. Everything comes full circle, as they see, even that phrase. Why do we say everything comes full circle means what? It's all connected, it all comes back around. And even the quote, I'm going to be a nerd right here and quote Doctor Who. And say he even said at one point, he goes when it was the 10th Doctor, David Tennant goes, everyone thinks that time travel is linear or time is linear, but it's really not. It's really actually a big ball of the wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff. And I'm quoting that directly, and it sounds nonsensical. But what he was saying was, it's not linear. It's more like a ball, like a circle of all this, you know, interconnectedness.
That's it. You know, it's funny. The traditional Hiyokas and the Lakotas and they don't use a round drum. They use a square drum. So there you go.
I believe it.
So right now, anyone who's listening, draw 8 directions. That's 8 triangles, right? You got a circle. You just created a circle.
There you go.
So
right?
I'm telling you, man, it's that geometrical math they use.
Yeah, see, this is where mathematicians can, you know, they know this, right? Because, like, math, again, was, like, a very original concept, and we know, like, a lot of ancient people, especially, like, in Mesoamerica, the Maya, the Aztec, the Inca, and even out in, like, ancient Egypt and ancient parts of Asia, we're using math, right, and to figure out cosmology, figure out a calendar and everything. That was all done through math and through combination of math and observation of their environment, right? Did I lose you?